Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, a show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health innovation, health policy, care delivery, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, Mark and Margaret speak with Andy Slavitt, former acting administrator of the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services under President Obama, founder of several entities since, Town Hall Ventures and United States of Care. Andy Slavitt is building a bipartisan coalition to advance health coverage for all Americans, especially as the country is grappling with a failing response to containing the COVID-19 pandemic. Lori Robertson also checks in, managing editor of factcheck.org, looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea that's improving health and well-being in everyday lives. If you have comments, email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook, Twitter, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can also hear us by asking Alexa to play the program Conversations on Healthcare. Now, stay tuned for our interview with Andy Slavitt here on Conversations on Healthcare.
We're speaking today with Andy Slavitt, former acting administrator for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services under President Obama. He's founder of the United States of Care and Town Hall Ventures, both entities aimed at advancing health reform and health coverage for Americans. Recently, he's been writing extensively on COVID-19. He also launched a new podcast, In the Bubble, addressing pandemic issues from his home studio bubble.
Mr. Slavitt led the team that fixed healthcare.gov. That was the online insurance portal created under the Affordable Care Act. And he also served on the Obama administration's heroin task force, as well as Vice President Joe Biden's cancer moonshot. Since 2017, he has dedicated his efforts to fighting the repeal of the ACA through the creation of bipartisan coalitions. Andy, we welcome you back to Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you know, and Andy, you joined us back in November 2019, ancient history.
Yep.
But, you know, I have a hypothetical question for you. If you were invited into the White House right now to help them solve this crisis that we're facing, what would you do right now? And I ask you this, you were brought onto the national stage when the Affordable Care Act online insurance portal, healthcare.gov, was put on life support, and you were part of what Time Magazine referred to as Obama's trauma team. And obviously, right now, I think our country is in trauma. What advice and what pathway would you advise the administration to head?
Well, I think it depends if you could persuade the president that it's in his best interest to provide moral leadership and to take accountability for the results in the country. I mean, right now, I think, you know, his belief seems to be that if he doesn't take accountability, doesn't collect the data, analyze it, discuss it honestly, doesn't deal with the hard facts and the hard truths, then he'll be able to blame someone else when things don't go well, whether it's governors or China or the WHO or someone else. If I couldn't persuade him of that, it wouldn't be all that fruitful. But I think the things that he should be doing and he can start doing right now are, one, presenting a very clear, honest case to the public that's fact-based. It's not based upon what he wants to believe or doesn't want to believe. I think he underestimates the public's ability and willingness to listen to hard truths. I think the public is very receptive to hard truths if they feel like they're getting told them in a straight way. And I think, you know, you build a competent and connected team of people around you that have a penchant for taking on issues and acting, showing compassion to the public, helping people understand that we're going through a very difficult time, and it's likely to be extended and felt differently everywhere. Those are the first critical steps, along with listening to your scientists, and let the scientists help you find your way out of this. There's no choice to reject the public health crisis in favor of the economy. The economy will not respond to that.
Well, Andy, as we watch the virus accelerate across the country and the daily news as everybody hits new targets, broke new records, it's hard to listen to the president excoriating his own CDC as well as Dr. Anthony Fauci, you know, arguably one of the most esteemed immunologists in the world and somebody that seems to have great respect among the American public. It doesn't seem like a winning strategy. And I guess the question is beyond just what would the White House and the president do different? How does the sort of collective we build consensus for public health interventions that the American people can trust and find reliable and reasonable, like wearing universal mask wearing in public, social distancing, avoiding the large crowds? These are things that it feels like takes beyond just the White House to try and get us to consensus. And what are your thoughts on this idea of threatening school districts with loss of funds if they don't fully open schools in a few weeks? We're just hearing such fear, confusion among educators and families around the country.
You're absolutely right. This is the blame for where we are doesn't fall on any one person or any one mm-hmm. place. It actually falls on the virus mm-hmm. itself.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a deadly bug, and we have to do our best to respond to it. So I would say that there are two things we've got to get better at. One of them is a failure to adapt, to learn. It's a novel virus, so we don't know anything going into it. And if our experts and our scientists say something in February or March that they then revise in April and May, that's good.
Right.
That's how it's supposed to happen.
Right.
We have to adapt. It's scary being in the middle of the scientific process, right? Because we want people to tell us the answers. But the truth is we're going to take two steps forward, one step back, sometimes two steps back, one step forward. And that's the way it's supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
But if we don't adapt, if scientists learn that there is an intervention like a mask that works better, even though we might have been told a month or two before that the mask isn't what we need, we have to adapt. And when New York goes through a crisis and Detroit goes through a crisis and the governor says, I've lost three people in my family, be careful. And he says that she says that to Florida and Arizona, they should learn that lesson from her, not have to learn it themselves. And I think that's the second failure I'd point to, which you've got to get better at, is it's almost a failure of imagination.
Hmm.
It's like if it hasn't happened to us,
mm-hmm.
then we don't believe it. So, you know, that failure of imagination turns into a failure of empathy.
Yeah.
All of us can be carriers, even if it's not dangerous to us, and it is more we don't know who it's going to be dangerous to or not.
Right.
But all of us can be carriers. So all of us can infect lots of people. So we have to show that level of empathy. And for no one else, for essential workers, for people working in the grocery store, for people delivering food, for everybody who has to work, we can't fail them.
You know, I wonder if there isn't a sort of a third obstacle, which is, it seems to me that we've lost our way in terms of finding bipartisanship. And, you know, you recently advised Jared Kushner in the Trump White House on COVID-19. And you've teamed up with the president's former FDA commissioner, Scott Gottlieb, to promote effective public health interventions to address the pandemic. I wonder if you could talk a little more about the bipartisan effort. It seems that we're operating in a red and blue state world when we've got to figure out how to come together. As we used to, I think, on foreign policy, we have to find that this is sort of the waterfront of where we need to come together. But talk a little bit about your thoughts about how we build a bipartisan coalition of building consensus on these tough health policies that the country faces.
I think it's very discouraging for people to see their elected officials fight over something that for them is an existential threat. And I think nothing would be more encouraging than seeing people come together and put aside other differences and say, we are on the same team, we are in this together. It's why I give Scott Gottlieb great credit and other folks who have joined us in these efforts, because we know that if we co-sign something, people will listen more than if either he put something out on his own or I put something out in my own. It feels more trusted because mm-hmm. it takes more effort. It takes more compromise. But neither of us are running for office, so it's easier for us to do. The politics in this country have gotten so bad that it's harder for other people to do that. So I think if there was a different Republican in the White House, Mitt Romney, say, or even George W. Bush, we would have a bipartisan response here. It doesn't mean there wouldn't be arguments over how much money to spend. It doesn't mean there wouldn't be some election year politics. But any other, quite honestly, Republican president in our lifetime understands the nature of a pandemic. George W. Bush was very worried about it. Pandemics. So I think that the politics are here right now because of President Trump has shaped the Republican Party, including many of the members of Congress. It's in his image, and people don't get out of line. I think it's very difficult for Republicans to compromise on what they believe is compromise on some of the things that I believe are good for the public mm-hmm. Right now, given the way the party is being run.
Well, I personally want to thank you and congratulate you on your efforts to uphold the ACA's health reform changes against some pretty mighty headwinds. I think it was Congressman Joe Kennedy III who lauded your efforts as almost single-handedly saving the ACA with your town hall strategy. You know, here we are in the midst of a pandemic. Every single person, you know, potentially a step away from being unable to work because either their job disappeared or they're ill. We saw a report this week that more than 5 million Americans have lost their health coverage due to COVID-related job losses. But maybe you could talk a bit about the ACA protections that you fought so hard to protect, which have such great meaning now for Americans as they enter this very vulnerable time.
Well, look, I was just one of millions who were at the time, and little did anybody know at the time that we'd be facing these circumstances.
Right. Look,
there is never a good time to take away people's healthcare coverage. You'll need a pandemic to demonstrate what a bad idea is. But what a pandemic brings out is a couple things. One, as you said, is all the people who are losing coverage because the connection between employment and insurance is there in society, whereas you're no less of a human being because you've been laid off or furloughed, and you've no less right to be able to care for your family. That should be obvious. But secondly, this whole notion of pre-existing conditions, you know, pre-existing conditions were designed for a simple reason. They were designed because the insurance system was designed to make sure that insurance companies could make money.
Mm-hmm.
It was designed by insurance companies.
Yeah.
It wasn't regulated to prevent that. And so that's designed that way. I would sure want to know if you were sick because I need to make money. And if you're sick and I didn't know that, then I need to charge you a lot more money or not offer you insurance. The ACA just flipped it around and said insurance companies need to be designed for individuals and insurance companies need to adjust. So imagine a world where tens of millions of people have had COVID-19. Then let's say a year from now, 2 years from now, you get asthma or you get a blood clot in your leg or you get PTSD. Your insurance company will be able to tell you that's all based upon this pre-existing condition of COVID-19. And by the way, if you were one of the millions of people who had COVID-19 and didn't know it, they will be able to actually just take away your coverage. And because according to the way that the rules work before the ACA, if you didn't disclose an illness,
then
your coverage could be eliminated.
That's
so it's a screwy world that in the first place, in this context, it would be obscene.
We're speaking today with Andy Slavitt, former acting administrator for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services under President Obama. And Andy, you know, since the advent of the pandemic, you've been writing extensively, but you also launched a podcast in the bubble addressing the pandemic from your home studio, which you're in now, the bubble, you know, featuring some really quite remarkable people. I know either you had or just about to have Dr. Larry Brilliant on, known as an epidemiologist who eradicated smallpox globally. I wonder if you could share their perspective about these global pandemics, but we need to learn from people who've seen this around the globe and how they've dealt with it there. But what have you extracted and learned from the experiences they've shared with you?
So first of all, the podcast is called In the Bubble. My 18-year-old son came to me and said, Dad, let's do a podcast together. You know, when your 18-year-old son comes to you and says,
let's do anything.
I have an 18-year-old. I know this. There's like no question.
He's stuck at home with me. It was a fun project. I describe it as 50% Winston Churchill, 50% Fred Rogers. So a reliable voice, a unifying voice and set of messages, and then helpful. So the whole family can listen to it because we're going to be dealing with this for a while. And there's lots of elements and lots of aspects to it. And so we have political people on, we have entertainers on, we have people talking about various aspects of what we're dealing with. So Larry Brilliant's going to be on. We have actually Senator Bernie Sanders coming on.
Oh, great.
And then the following week, we've got Ambassador Rice. But Larry Brilliant was very interesting because, you know, he of course, gave a TED Talk in 2005, which predicted almost exactly where we'd be. And of course, he was the technical director of a movie, Contagion, which was very close to where we are. And I said, are we better or worse than you thought we'd be handling it? He said, in effect, he feels worse today than he did the day the pandemic started.
Wow.
And I went through piece by piece and he said, I feel the scientists get an A-. He said certain members of the public get an A+, because they've been out the front line saving lives. He said the public as a whole, there are a lot of people he's disappointed in. And he said our political leaders, his grade was, I believe his phrase was special place in hell.
Mm. Yeah.
because he said we would not have beaten it in terms of eradicating it, but we would have contained it by now with proper leadership. He said everything we've seen from this virus, hard, challenging, but all within our scope to manage, as has Vietnam, as has the Czech Republic, as has Greece, as has New Zealand, as has a whole set of diverse countries.
Sure.
And he said, when we did all of our planning, the one thing we didn't plan on was essentially a national response of denial and indifference.
Well, Andy, as a society, we are not accustomed to the kind of constraints that we've had. We want schools open. We want to celebrate with our families at gatherings. We want to cheer our favorite sports teams in person. But you write so eloquently that if we can't see our past, then we don't know where we're going. And we know we need great data. We need testing capacity. We need the data from the testing. Our frontline workers, their burnout isn't going away. Still concerns about adequate PPE, and you warn that further shortages are looming. You're promoting a campaign to open safely. What does that mean to you? How do we protect our healthcare workforce and the population at large as we brace ourselves for what we have to assume will be additional waves of the pandemic?
These are tough times. You know, people are going through a lot of anxiety, a lot of challenges, not just health, not just financial, but their social structure isn't there for them. I mean, in World War II, we had, you know, people had each other. We haven't had that. And, you know, unless you're a Bears fan, it's a tough time. I mean, you know, there's certain sports teams. I'm a Chicago sports fan. You know, for me, they're not losing right now. And so the question is not, do we close down or do we open up? The question is, how do we open up safely? Because Americans want to get back to normal life, but they don't want to do it at the expense of their neighbors' lives.
Yeah.
You know, we have 20% of our population that is forced to work, and essentially they're doing services for the rest of the population, but we're really taking advantage as a society. So things are not safe for them. And if they're not safe for others, they're not going to do things that drive the economy, spend money, buy cars, travel, sign new leases, hire employees, the things that make an economy come back. Sure, people who are well off will spend money and people will get haircuts and those things. But that's not going to drive an economy. So do you have to choose between an economy or solving the public health crisis? And I think, as the rest of the world has shown, if you can solve the public health crisis by making people feel safe, by making people feel like, yes, there will be cases, but they will be contained. You'll be able to have lots of testing, so you'll know at all times your status. The economy can actually go on. If you don't do that, and you can't get access to a test or a test result for weeks, and you don't have enough personal protective equipment, then all you know is that you've got thousands and thousands of people walking around spreading the virus, who many of them don't have any symptoms, and you're in complete out of control until such time as someone shows up at the hospital.
Yeah.
And by that time, the train has left the station.
Yeah.
So it's not complicated. You know, people know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
The White House plan put forward by Dr. Birx did pretty much that. The president just chose to ignore it. He just chose, the day after he put it out, to send out a tweet saying, liberate Michigan and liberate Minnesota. You know, one day's attention span is not going to get us there.
You know, I want to get your thoughts on the healthcare system as a whole. You know, it seems like we're at this inflection point as we think about maybe not today, but in the near future, about how we might redesign and reframe the healthcare infrastructure here in this country. We've seen this rapid adoption of telehealth. There's much more, though, associated with the opportunities that are in front of us. I know at our organization, we're trying to sort of look at that path forward, if you will. And I'm wondering what your vision is of how the ongoing transformation might be foundational to a new American healthcare system.
So there's three things I think that become crystal clear to anybody paying attention about our healthcare system. And I wrote about it in a piece in JAMA that came out July 3rd.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond the basics, three things that really stood out as things that needed change. The first is we have to disconnect employment and insurance, and we have to substitute that with existence. I exist, therefore, I get insurance, not I'm employed, I get insurance, because it's too tenuous a link, not just during a pandemic, but younger generations of people are employed very differently and they will be employed very differently. The second, we need to put the center of the relationship with our physicians, not with our with insurance companies. We should be setting up relationships and paying directly care providers with some sort of capitated value-based payment. And the reason I say that is because in the middle of this crisis, people pay their insurance premiums.
Right.
And where did that insurance premium sit? It sat with insurance companies and doctor's offices, who could have been the ones investing in people's health with that money, were struggling.
Right.
So we can't have a system that works for a middleman only. And the system, the way it's designed, exacerbated problems. It didn't protect. There was no built-in resilience. You know, the role that insurance companies play, many of those functions are valuable, but they should sit behind the care provider,
right,
to help them take risk, manage care, coordinate care, et cetera. And they could be paid for out of what's paid to a healthcare organization. And then the third thing is we need a healthcare system that's built on equity, that doesn't think about and talk about equity and disparities as an afterthought. It doesn't mean the same. It means we get a healthcare system that are designed for people's circumstances. Many people live in communities where they don't have broadband. They live in communities where they don't have access to maternal health, parts of the country where people are older and they're sicker or don't speak English, and we expect them to come to us. And our system is hard enough to navigate for people who are pretty good at navigating mm-hmm. it. You're taking two buses to a dialysis appointment. We're not going to get people healthier that way. So we need a system that is designed with those needs in mind. We need to stop reporting average piece of data. We're growing this by 5%. Quality is here. We have to start talking about how that affects different subgroups.
Yeah.
When I was running CMS, and I used to go talk to a hospital CEO, and he would say, we're doing great in the triple aim because we've increased quality scores by 5%. My first question would be, what's happened to quality scores for your bottom quintile?
Yeah.
Bottom 20%. How far apart are they from the average?
Yeah.
Well, we don't know.
Yeah.
How about rural health community? Don't know. How about Black community? Don't know. The average doesn't matter.
Right.
We talk about the average, we're talking about suburban, middle class, white people. And guess what? They're doing fine. The problem is we don't put any attention on the people that the healthcare system is failing for, which numbers about 130 million people when you add it up.
We've been speaking today with Andy Slavitt, former acting administrator of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services under President Obama and the founder of United States of Care and Town Hall Ventures. You can follow his podcast, In the Bubble, and his writings on Medium by going to unitedstatesofcare.org and townhallventures.com, or follow him on Twitter at @aslavitt. Andy, thank you so much for your ongoing passion for improving American healthcare, for your commitment to finding bipartisan solutions, and for sharing your story on Conversations on Healthcare.
Thanks for having me.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reported that through May 30th, 14% of confirmed coronavirus cases led to hospitalizations, including 2% in intensive care units. But President Donald Trump falsely claimed 99% of cases are, quote, totally harmless. The president, according to his press secretary, was referring to the case fatality rate, and he claimed the amount of testing the U.S. has conducted showed this. The testing actually showed a case fatality rate of 4.5% when the president made his comment over the July 4th weekend. But not everyone who has contracted COVID-19, the disease caused by the virus, has been tested. Some estimates say the fatality rate among those infected is likely around 1%. Columbia University epidemiologist Stephen Morse told us, quote, some estimates do place the mortality at about 1%. But he said that didn't mean 99% of cases were totally harmless. In addition to those who die, many are hospitalized. In June, the CDC published data on the 1.3 million reported cases in the U.S. from January 22nd to May 30th, finding that 14% of patients were hospitalized, 2% were in the ICU, and 5% died. The World Health Organization also says that 13.8% of confirmed coronavirus patients have severe disease and 6.1% have critical cases. Dr. Ashish Jha, faculty director of the Harvard Global Health Institute, said that the broad consensus is that the infection fatality rate is between 0.6% and 1%, but that varies based on whether a population is older or younger. But if someone spends weeks in a hospital and survives, Jha said, quote, that was not inconsequential. Even if the infection fatality rate is about 1%, that's a lot of people, said Dr. Lee Riley, professor and chair of the Division of Infectious Disease and Vaccinology at the University of California, Berkeley School of Public Health. There are also the financial ramifications of treatment, the impact on hospitals of the pandemic, and the burden to the U.S. health system, Riley told us. Not much is known about how frequently COVID-19 patients suffer long-term effects, but there are signs that the disease does not always completely resolve itself as rapidly as expected. And that's my Fact Check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Anxiety disorders are on the rise among the nation's youth, and experts in the field of child psychology feel the condition starts much earlier in childhood and is far more common than previously thought, with an estimated 1 in 5 children being affected. But too often, these so-called internalizing disorders go undiagnosed. Unlike children with more expressive conditions such as ADHD or autism spectrum disorder, young kids struggling with anxiety or depression often internalize their symptoms and may just seem like an introvert to the casual observer. University of Vermont child psychologist Ellen McGinnis says the process of diagnosis for younger children is often painstaking and can take months to confirm. Dr. McGinnis says the traditional method of diagnosis involves creating scenarios that induce anxiety, followed by behavioral observation by clinicians, and the results can be inexact. So she teamed up with her husband and fellow researcher, biomedical engineer Ryan McGinnis, to create a wearable sensor that can pick up on physical cues that suggest the presence of anxiety, using accelerometers and simple algorithms to compare normal stress responses.
The device is called an inertial measurement unit, and it's about the size of a business card. And so we strap that to belts on each child. And when they did the mood induction task, it has an accelerometer in it. And so we're able to pick up, you know, angular velocity, speed, how much the child is bending forward and backward and turning side to side. And it actually picks up 100 samples per second. So much more than the, you know, eye can see. So we were able to see if kids with anxiety and depression move differently in response to a potential threatening information. And they do. So kids with a disorder turn further away from the potential threat than kids without a disorder.
Their research paper shows the device was nearly 85% accurate in making a correct diagnosis. And she says early diagnosis is the key to avoiding more damaging manifestations of anxiety disorder later on. A simple, wearable tool that can assist parents and clinicians in determining if a child is suffering from anxiety disorder, leading to less guesswork and more rapid diagnosis and treatment. Now that's a bright idea. You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU, at Wesleyan University, streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.